2001 covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast, on Sirius Satellite Radio, on RadioPower.org, and on WhiteRoseSociety.org, also being podcast at WhiteRoseSociety.org, and Apple's iTunes. Welcome to our program. Valerie Plame. What is the significance of this whole thing? First of all, in the big scheme of things, I think the thing that we need to keep in mind, continuously keep in mind, is that at one level, it's not about Valerie Plame and Karl Rove and Joe Wilson. It's about George W. Bush's attempts to lie us into a war, and then Joe Wilson trying to tell the truth about that. But George wanted to have his war because he wanted to get, as he told his biographer, the fellow who wrote his autobiography, or wrote the first draft of his autobiography, A Charge to Keep, back in 1999, as before he became president, as he told his the fellow who was writing his autobiography, if he became president and had an opportunity to attack Iraq, he wouldn't screw it up like his father did and waste all that political capital that he would get from being a war president. He would instead use that political capital to get his agenda passed, his agenda of privatizing Social Security, basically rolling back the New Deal, ending the New Deal. He would use his political capital to do that. And it's you know, certainly something that, in fact, you know, Rush Limbaugh, for example, says, you know, this is what we're all about. Just, you know, very, very straightforward, in fact, saying that that's what they're all about. Roosevelt is dead. You know, get over it. That's Limbaugh's take on the whole thing. In fact, here we have
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
But in the meantime, there's that bigger picture, but there's also then what Karl Rove did and to whom he did it. And that's worthy of examination as well. And in that context, we have with us today, Larry Johnson. Larry is a former CIA officer, a registered Republican, a guy who knows the intelligence business on the inside out, and a fellow who actually went through spy school with Valerie Plame. Am I mischaracterizing that, Larry?
No, it's all accurate.
Spy school?
Well, the career trainee program. It was covered a whole host of things: an introduction to the CIA, introduction to the different directorates, an opportunity to work in different offices, serve internships, paramilitary training, field officer, tradecraft, you know, a whole variety of things. So
sounds fascinating, actually.
Yeah, it was a fun year.
So, and you went through this with Valerie Plame. Now, you point out in an article that you wrote, or in testimony that you delivered to the U.S. Senate Democratic Policy Committee back in 2003, that there is a difference in the kind of operation that people like you and Valerie Plame can choose to take. You can choose to be spies in different ways, and there's kind of a safe way and a dangerous way. Can you explain that for us?
Well, there are two types of cover. I mean, everybody who was in our class when we started in September of 1985 were put undercover. Most people at CIA who are undercover have what is known as official cover, which means that you are assumed to be working for one part of the U.S. government. But then there are another group of people who are put under what's called non-official cover. And that means when you travel overseas, you may or may not travel with a U.S. passport, but you certainly do not have a diplomatic passport.
Well, let me back up just a second. You said with official cover, like you're actually a CIA agent, but you're pretending to be a State Department official or something like that.
Your cover status lists you as working for another government agency.
Right.
And I don't identify even the specific government agencies because I just don't think that's helpful to people being able to maintain their cover.
Yeah, well, I didn't mean to out the State Department or anything like that. I was just like, for instance, you know, there would be some government agency, and because you're working for that government agency, you're entitled to get a black passport, a black cover passport. That is a diplomatic passport, right?
Correct. U.S. government employees who go overseas are always given a black passport. So you've got that.
And now what happens to you if you're caught spying in, say, Egypt or Afghanistan or something like that, and you've got a black passport?
It's never good to get caught. First rule of thumb is don't get caught. But if you do get caught and you have a black passport, it's a get-out-of-jail-free card.
They have to put you on a plane and ship you back to the United States.
You get treated as a U.S. diplomat, and it's an embarrassing moment for the U.S. government, and, you know, it can ruffle relations with that country. However, if you're there as a non-official cover officer and you are picked up, you can be executed. You have no protection. And Valerie was a non-official cover officer. Of that, there is absolutely no doubt.
So she took the greatest chance that a CIA officer can take.
Yeah, absolutely.
And she did that for what reason?
Because she's a patriot. You know, she's all about serving her country. And she was not about serving partisan political agendas, as has been alleged by some at the White House who are out there just, you know, flat out spreading lies about her and about her motivations.
How, as a former CIA officer and as a Republican, how do you respond to Rove and now we got Newt Gingrich out here running around doing the talk show circuit and Tom DeLay and all these other guys, but particularly Gingrich, you know, just spreading the stuff, you know, spreading the fertilizer, as it were,
yeah,
about how Joe Wilson was really a partisan hack. Valerie Plame actually got him the job. She did it because she wanted to make Bush look bad, blah-de, 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 blah.
Yeah, well, number one, it's sickening, and number two, they are lies. It's just not true. You know, I part of the reason I became a Republican was a deep-seated belief that it was the Republican Party had a better vision for protecting the security of this country and had committed to limited government power. Now what we've seen is that the Republicans, you know, are completely disregarding and not willing to pay any kind of attention whatsoever to what has happened here in this case. They're trying to parse words, much as the Clinton administration was parsing words about what sex is and depending on what the meaning of is, except in this case, this doesn't involve someone's sexual affair with an intern. This involves the national security of the United States because they have divulged the name not only of a clandestine operative, but it divulged the name of the front company that she was affiliated with. And when you divulge the name of that front company, then it's like creating a trail of breadcrumbs that any foreign intelligence service, up to and including someone like Al-Qaeda, can follow, because you can go back and you can find out who did this company do business with, who were the individuals associated with this company, which individuals received payment from that company. And that allows you to potentially identify a network of foreign intelligence agents who are working on behalf of the U.S. government and perhaps committing treason against their own country. And that's where the damage is done. And in this case, I don't care whether it necessarily represents a violation of the law that was drafted to protect the identity of covert officers, but what it does represent is a violation of President Bush's oath to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States and, by implication, the people of this country. And when you allow a political operative to remain on your staff who was directly implemented in an effort to out a clandestine officer, you are violating that oath.
Yeah, but George Bush claims that he had no idea. George Bush on this.
And I don't know. We're going to find out. The senior administration official. Now, this is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
Now, Larry, you've worked in government. You've worked in the CIA. Certainly, you know how government works on the inside. We're talking, by the way, with Larry Johnson, former CIA officer, registered Republican, former classmate of Valerie Plame's. You think it's possible that Karl Rove did this and Bush didn't know about it?
It's possible. I mean, I think, again, the most likely scenario is that the day that Joe Wilson's op-ed appeared in the New York Times, which was July 6th, that I'm sure, you know, George Bush and who Joe Wilson was. But when they were briefed on or made aware of this, it would be natural to say, who is this Joe Wilson character?
Right.
And what is this about? And in the process, though, there somebody let the president and the vice president know what was going on, and in the process of that, communicated to them about Valerie's employment with the CIA. That was then passed by someone to the political operatives and Karl Rove's staff. I find it difficult to believe that Rove had the clearances for this, and someone gave him that information.
So the bigger question then becomes, who told Karl Rove, and could it have been George W. Bush himself who told Karl Rove this?
I doubt it would be Bush, but it was someone, someone on Bush's staff and Cheney's staff, national security staff. Now, the initial information was communicated by a CIA officer, I'm sure, but the CIA officer was communicating to people who actually had clearances to know this information.
Yeah.
The fact that it was in the Bush White House that they decided to make a political issue of it. And you know, the falsehoods that have been spread about this to the extent of insisting that somehow Valerie Plame was this covert Democratic operative who hired her husband to go over and embarrass the White House is just, it's laughable. Number one, she was not in a decision-making position. She didn't have the authority to command or direct. And number two, her boss was the one who hired Joe Wilson and asked him to go.
Yeah.
And again, this was all as Wilson had at first said, that the vice president's office had made a request of the CIA. That fact is verified in the Senate Intelligence Committee report from last year. And Joe was ultimately asked to go over and check it out.
Yeah. Now, when Karl Rove outed Valerie Plame, and then when Bob Novak, the day later or a couple days later, went on to name Brewster Jennings, I believe was the name of the company, as Valerie Plame's company, what happened in Cairo? What happened in Kabul? What happened in the Middle Eastern capitals where this company presumably was working? Brewster Jennings was one of the founders of I believe, of Mobil Oil and a heavy participant early on in Aramco, right?
Well, I'm not familiar with all the details of that, but immediately what happens in all of those capitals with any marginally competent intelligence organization is they start searching their files to find out who, if anyone, had any contact with this company and who, if anyone in their country was affiliated in any fashion.
So in Afghanistan, they discover that, Joe Blow or Tariq Aziz or whatever, you know, it's a fill in an Afghan name, or Iraq, you know, an Iraqi name, was in their official capacity as an employee of the state oil company, was doing business with Brewster Jennings and might have had a meeting even with Valerie Plame of Brewster Jennings, and now they know that Joe Blow or Tariq, whatever his name is actually one of two things. Either he's a dupe or he's a double agent, a spy within their own country, and they go and get him, and they take him and his family out, and they execute them, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's one plausible scenario.
So will we ever know how many people might have been killed as a result of Karl Rove committing this act of treason?
I do not know if the CIA has conducted a damage assessment. They should have conducted a damage assessment, and that should have been briefed to the Senate and House Intelligence Committees. And so far, I think if they had produced a report that said that there was absolutely no damage, that would have certainly been leaked to the press by now.
By this administration.
Right. So that suggests to me that there was some damage that's not being admitted publicly, because once the information about the damage comes out, it's just going to be a further stain upon this administration.
We just have a few seconds left. Larry Johnson, former CIA officer. How do you think the CIA is handling this? The people within the CIA.
Well, I know friends of mine who are still active case officers are appalled by it and made nervous by the fact that they recognize that this administration has been willing to play politics with intelligence officers. Remember, this is the same administration that tried to fire intelligence officers at the CIA and at the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research through John Bolton. So,
there's John Bolton.
This is not an isolated incident.
Yeah.
This is the pattern.
Well, Larry Johnson, I salute your service to your country and your patriotism and your willingness to stand up and speak out. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom.
It's 20 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Harbin.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
First we'll frisk you, then we'll test you, and it won't be so bad if you should fail. Tell my friends if they arrest you, 'cause they've also spent time in jail. You will arrest you, attention's checkered, but we'll keep you in the line all day and night.
Yeah, you just try and get through an airport.
Because we'll have a perfect record, as long as no one makes their flight.
Welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. 1-866-889-8894. Our toll-free number all across the United States. George W. Bush George W. Bush is where this thing really begins and ends, and we so have to keep our eye on that ball. This is the beginning and end of it. You know, Rove saying, "Ah, I didn't reveal a name." Ken Mellman running around. Ken Mellman, the guy who now is formerly was Rove's aide. He was the number two guy to Karl Rove. I mean, remember? And then during the election 2004, he was running ads, posting ads on gay bulletin boards, saying that he was looking for a partner for casual sex. And, you know, I have no problem with that, except for the fact that he's part of a machine that's bashing gays. The hypocrisy stinks to high heaven. And then Ken Mellman coming out, he's doing the circuit right now as the chairman of the RNC, saying, no, Rove didn't reveal a name. Sorry, the law doesn't say you have to reveal a name. It says you have to reveal an identity. Joe Wilson's wife is an identity. It's very simple. I mean, this is we're talking a serious crime here. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Tom in Portland, Oregon on the line. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Actually, I had a couple of comments, but they were about your local show here.
Yeah, we can't talk about that right now, Tom. I'm sorry.
Oh, we can't? Okay.
No, because folks listening to this, the national program didn't hear the local program.
Okay, well, let me add one thing, okay? Did
sure.
you hear Joe Wilson this morning on the Today Show? Probably not, because you were doing your show.
I did not. I was on the air.
Okay, well, one of the points that Joe Wilson made today on his show, or on the Today Show, was the fact that Valerie Plame's name is Mrs. Joseph Wilson, and so therefore he did actually name her by name.
Yeah, okay, good. Thank you, Tom, and thanks for the call. Yes, but he didn't even have to. I mean, the law simply says it's illegal to reveal the identity of an agent who is undercover and who the government is taking proactive steps to keep secret. And that was certainly the case with Valerie Plame, or Valerie Wilson, or Mrs. Joe Wilson. Mike in Washington, D.C. on the line. Hey, Mike, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Good morning, Tom. Three quick points for you. One, I'm still trying to figure out how and under what circumstances Rove got the uber secret clearance that he needed to get this information, because at the time he was not a member, he was not the deputy director.
Well, this is the thing that Larry Johnson brings up, is who's the guy who told Rove this?
Correct. I mean, another...
George Bush had access to it, Dick Cheney had access to it, probably Scooter Libby had access to it, but Karl Rove, maybe not.
Well, not legally.
Yeah.
Not legally. Secondly, I was thinking when you were talking to Larry Johnson about how this came about and did Bush order it. Well, you know, it reminds me of Henry and Becket. Wasn't it Henry II that said, "Who will rid me of this meddlesome priest?"
Yes.
And four of his knights went over and slaughtered Becket.
Yep.
Canterbury.
Yep. Yep. Yep.
Same kind of thing.
Yeah. He didn't say, "Please go kill them." He just simply asked the rhetorical question. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, thirdly, the spin coming out of the dryer, I guess, is unbelievable. Oh no, Wilson lied. Everybody knew he was lying. His report was discredited. Where did they come up with this?
Well, see, they're still trying to convince us that there was uranium in Niger that Saddam Hussein was trying to get his hands on, and that Saddam Hussein represented a threat. I mean, they're still trying to spin the same lies that they've been trying to spin before. I mean, it's just this is you know, keep the lies going, because once the lies break down, then you discover that the invasion of Iraq was illegal and for no purpose whatsoever other than to serve George W. Bush's political needs. 29 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. Mike, thanks for the call.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
The fact is that they tell you lies, that they'd get different names, like collateral damage. The fact is that the dead, they all had different plans. They all had names and faces, hopes and dreams. The fact is war solves nothing, makes a lot of people dead, and a few rich people happy.
Stop the war.
And welcome back. 27 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Yes, armies are really good at blowing things up, breaking things, and killing people. And there is an appropriate time and place for that. And when George W. Bush said that he had won the war, he had won the invasion, excuse me, he was speaking, you know, more or less, he was speaking truth when George Bush said,
"My fellow Americans, major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed."
Now, that was the truth, and we did prevail in the Battle of Iraq. We had a successful invasion. But then Bush had to keep on talking, and he went on to say,
"The Battle of Iraq is one victory in a war on terror that began on September the 11th, 2001.
I'm sorry, it's not. It's got nothing to do with 9/11. Nothing to do with 9/11. And what's really weird is that George Bush himself said,
"We've had no evidence that Saddam Hussein was involved with the September the 11th.
No. We've had no evidence." Now, why is this clip not being played on mainstream media? I mean, I would think that this would be played. You know, this was in a news conference about a year and a half ago. He simply said this, and this was September 17th of last year. No connection to 9/11.
"We've had no evidence that Saddam Hussein was involved with the September the 11th.
And then he gets on the aircraft carrier and says, "Saddam Hussein, 9/11. They're trying to keep the people in the United States in a state of absolute confusion. And the fog machine is out there. I'm telling you, the fog machine is out there trying, just ginning this thing up, just stirring it up. Newt Gingrich and company, they're out there. 1-866-889-8894, a telephone number. Sharon in Portland, Oregon on the line. Hey, Sharon, what's up?
Well, I'm admiring your expertise at being a talk show host.
Thank you.
You're doing a great job. It sounds like you've really been around, too, around the world. Wow. Listen, I have to say that, in my opinion, there are more people. This may not sound very nice, but I think the whole country isn't just Terry Schiavo, who's brain dead, but the entire country has to be totally brain dead, not to see that this is not a conspiracy, what's happening, but a continuing business relationship as described in Craig Unger's book, House of Bush, House of Saud. Now, let me make my case. I believe that 9/11 was the shot out of the gate, but it continues today because most of the suicide bombers in Iraq are from Saudi Arabia. You know that's true, right?
Yeah, although most people who watch Fox News don't know that's true. 15 out of the 19 suicide bombers presumably were from Saudi Arabia. Now, after they were identified, five of them were found to be alive and well in various parts of the world. Five of the so-called suicide bombers, either four or five of them. And that's still kind of a question that's dangling for me. I'm still a little baffled by that. But
well, what I'm baffled about is that the Wall Street Journal, of all places, of all newspapers, put an article in, "Bin Laden Family is Tied to U.S. Group, Thursday, September 27th, 2001, written by Wall Street Journal staff reporters Daniel Golden and James Bandler. From Boston, and you can go to that on their website.
The U.S. group that you're talking about, I'm assuming, is the Carlyle Group?
That's correct.
Yeah, this was not a secret. It's never been a secret.
Yeah, and so we have this total and complete Saudi Arabian, not conspiracy, but continuing business relationship.
Sure, sure.
Where with the Bush family, the Bush crime family, and I believe that a person would have to be brain dead to not ask the question, how did Building 7 go down?
Yeah, well, that's a whole other thing because that...
No, it's not a whole other thing.
Let me finish my sentence, Sharon. It requires a certain amount of information to even ask that question. Again, I don't think that the American people are brain dead. I think that they're not getting good information from their media.
Well, I think they're brain dead because it's all okay. I'm a brain dead person when it comes to the internet, and I found this article about the Bin Laden family written within the same, practically the same month as the world had, when the World Trade Center went down.
Yeah.
And I saw Michael Moore's movie Fahrenheit 9/11, and I'm putting two and two together, and I am kind of not all that swift.
Yeah. Well, Sharon, I got it. And I got to say, the vast majority of Americans are just trying to do their jobs. They're just trying to get by day to day. They're just trying to feed their families, or as George W. Bush would say, put food on their families. And they're not paying attention to the media, and what they are paying attention to in the media, when they do pay attention to the media, what they're getting is garbage. They're just, it's just absolute garbage that they're getting. They're not getting the news that really matters. It's not happening. They're hearing about Michael Jackson. You know, they're hearing about Michael Jackson. They're hearing about, it was O.J. Simpson before that, is the Runaway Bride. I mean, so on. And it's because we have moved in this country from information to infotainment, and it's just a very, very destructive thing. Scott in San Diego on the line. Hey, Scott, what's up?
Well, good morning, Tom. We're having Portland weather in San Diego today.
Oh, that's marvelous. It's raining down there, you mean?
Not quite. It's looking like it wants to.
Oh, it's a beautiful sunny day here, so go figure.
Anyway, you're talking
must
about...
Must be a conspiracy.
Must be a conspiracy. Got a couple of things. I'll run through them real quick. You were talking about pigeon theory this morning, conspiracy theory. If you notice when Junior talks, he looks like a pigeon. He looks like a pigeon when he talks. Seriously, he does.
What Scott's referring to is a friend of mine in New York's theory that pigeons are not actually animals, that they are spies that the mother ship brings down once a year, drops off. They go around with their little eye cameras and their ear recording devices and listen to everything we're saying. Whenever there's a world meeting of major world leaders, there's always pigeons. And then once a year, they go back up into the mother ship. And the proof of this is that you never see baby pigeons and you never see dead pigeons, and therefore they're actually robots. So anyhow, yeah.
He looks like a pigeon when he talks.
Yeah.
I wanted to follow up with calling for support for candidates. It's so much fun. I did a lot of calls last night. I talked to a couple Republicans, and they're not happy with their party.
Yeah.
It reflects in the mayor campaign here in San Diego.
And Americans in general are not happy with the Republican Party, and they're not happy with George W. Bush. And it's giving the heebie-jeebies to a lot of Republicans. And I'm telling you that the moderates are going to reemerge in the next election. And the scary thing from my point of view is that the main moderate is probably going to be Chuck Hagel, who, before he became a senator, was the president of the company that's now ESNS, the voting machine company. And,
how coincidental. They had never had a Republican senator there before. Until this guy shows up.
Well, not for like 40 or 50 years, not since the Great Depression. Yeah.
Odd coincidence.
Yeah, it is. And life is full of them, Scott. It's just absolutely full of them. Thanks for the call. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, Steve in Tampa, Florida on the line. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hey. Just got a comment that I haven't heard anybody saying on any of these talk show hosts lately. And that's that we've been hearing over and over again, well, Karl Rove, how could he have done this, and how's he going to get away with it? And Bush with Downing Street, how'd he done it? How's he going to get away with it? Same thing with DeLay, and you guys think they're above the law. And given the current way that the administration is running and the current government in this country, they're absolutely right. These guys are above the law right now.
Yeah, they're running this government like a mob family would run a badly run city.
Yeah, I mean, Rove only answers to Bush. Bush supposedly answers to Congress.
No,
Congress
Bush says he answers to God.
Voter. Yeah, I guess. Congress only supposedly answers the American voter, and the American voter seems to be answering to Karl Rove.
Yeah.
Nobody seems to have anybody to answer for.
A strange cycle. Well said, Steve. Thank you very much for the call. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number. Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan on the line. Hey, Rick, what's on your mind today?
Tom, don't compare the Bush family to the mob. That's unfair to the mob. They have some honor.
Well, yeah.
Anyway.
And tradition, yes.
And a code of honor. I wanted to comment a little bit on this Karl Rove thing where you mentioned you thought the moderates had reemerged by 2008. I hope so, because it would seem to me that unlike Watergate, where people like Barry Goldwater just said, he had it with Nixon and this was the most dishonest man he'd ever met in his life, we've got...
Well, Barry Goldwater was a stand-up guy. I mean, he was the John McCain of his era. John McCain is sitting in his seat, in fact.
Yeah, where's Eisenhower when we need him? But anyway... Yeah. The thing of it is that I watched Ann Coulter last night, and in between looking weird in the eyes and playing with her hair and rolling her eyes, and they didn't have a full shot of her. She probably would have uncrossed her legs a few times. She kept calling Joe Wilson Clown Wilson. I don't know what that's all about. And a certain, I won't even mention this guy's name, you know, the fellow that's on from 12 to 3 nationwide, the right winger?
Yeah, yeah.
He's saying that Valerie Plame and Joe Wilson should be shot, not Rove. Now, this kind of vicious rhetoric.
Actually, that was Peter King who said that. He said it on MSNBC's Scarborough Country yesterday.
The same guy who was against Clinton's impeachment? That's hard to believe.
Yeah, Peter King. And Congressman Peter King, Republican of New York, he's the same guy who Nancy Pelosi's daughter interviewed him just before the election, just before the 2004 election. And she said, who do you think is going to win, or something to that effect. And this is on her video. And he says, it's all over now but the counting, and we're taking care of that. Right, with regard to the vote. It's all over but the counting. We're going to take care of that. So Peter King yesterday, he says, this is on Scarborough Country. He says, and I think people like Tim Russert and the others who give this guy, Joe Wilson, such a free ride, and all the media, they're the ones to be shot. Shot. The media. Peter King saying, we should be shot in the media. So I just, you know, it's creepy. It's creepy. This is, I mean, the agenda, very simply, they make no bones about it. Roll back the New Deal.
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
Very simple, very straightforward. Get rid of the New Deal. Just, you know, undo it, roll it back, get rid of it. No more, we don't, you know, period, that's it. No more Social Security, no more unemployment insurance, no more consumer inflation. Can't have the middle class getting wealthier. Nobody talks about CEO inflation. One of the headlines in today's New York Times, no evidence of consumer inflation. Gee, you know, it is bizarre, I got to tell you. It is just absolutely bizarre. And, you know, Larry Johnson talking about this. Peter Fredson wrote an op-ed piece that it's a blog, on his blog. And he says, senators pressed their avid noses into the metaphorical crotch of a buxom intern and reveled in details of kneeling pads, cigars, and positions taken. Drooling seemed to occur daily with calls for far ever more details. Some of the sex-repressed senators must have come close to sexual satisfaction with juicy details of how stains got on a dress. Clinton responded with a definition of what is, and several distinguished senators came close to apoplexy before and after terms of impeachment. Clearly, certainly nearly half of Congress decided that lying merited impeachment, if not castration. Their wrath, their fuming and fulminating were a high theater for people glued to their television screen, and it is reported that several adventurous souls tried variations of the missionary position by reading the Kama Sutra. When does lying, he says, when does lying become treason? Is it not when lives are lost on the basis of deliberate misinformation? Did Bill Clinton commit treason? Has George W. Bush committed treason? And here's another thing. This question in my mind. I seem to recall, and I may be wrong about this, but I seem to recall that Bob Novak claimed that he had two sources for his information. Who was the other source? Or, as Larry Johnson says, who told Karl Rove that Joe Wilson's wife was a CIA agent? Good question. Michael in Santa Clara, California. Hi. Hey, Michael.
Hey, how you doing?
Great. What's up?
Yeah, you have a great show. Okay, this is the point. You know, there must be something that all these Republicans around the country know that we don't know. Okay? They all, let me put it this way. What's the chances of George Bush losing an election and giving up power knowing that as soon as he's not the president of the United States, he's going to be charged with war crimes? I mean, you know, there's a lot of bad things that he's done.
Yeah.
And he's going to have
Republicans
to pay
in general. Yeah, this is why, you know, you read the summary of the investigation that was done in Ohio, you know, what went wrong in Ohio. And you say, whoa, wait a minute, this guy didn't actually win. The exit polls were right.
Right. I mean,
John Kerry
won the
election.
But you have to look. There is a lot of, you know, I'm not a Republican, but there's a lot of good Republicans. And what's making them staying loyal. Let's take John.
Well, I think a lot of good Republicans are not staying loyal. Michael, I think that they're walking away from this guy.
Yeah, I haven't seen. I was really disappointed to see someone like John McCain get trounced on by George Bush, and then, you know, at any chance he gets, you know, he's in George Bush's corner publicly.
Well, John McCain wants to be president. I mean, his presidential ambitions are eclipsing his good sense, in my opinion.
Yeah, you know, and one more thing, the lady that called, I'm with you.
Yeah.
I know exactly what you were trying to say, and I'm there, and I'm just wondering when people are going to say it, that, you know, I think that they had something to do with 9/11, period.
Yeah, my take on it is that it was neglect, that they knew that it was coming, that they could have done something to stop it, and they chose not to. And whether they chose not to because they thought they could capitalize on it politically or not, I don't know, but it wouldn't surprise me. Because
I'm sorry, Mr. Hartman. My take on it is they planned it.
Oh, you think they planned it? Yeah. See,
absolutely.
I can't go that far. I think that they knew about it. But,
right.
You know, I respect that point of view. I know that there's a startling amount of evidence out there about
it. Well, great show. I'm an old Air America listener, and you guys are doing a much better job than they ever could. So, thank you.
Thank you, Michael. Thanks for the call. Great to hear from you. It's 10 minutes before the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
And I'm taking my country back.
Yes, indeed.
Son, you ain't been doing her right. Oh, I've been watching you and I don't like how you've been treating my stars and stripes.
It's time to take our country back.
Our jobs and send them overseas. Now we owe billions to the red Chinese. So I'm taking my country back.
There you go. Welcome back, my friends. 4 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number. Smitty in Maryland driving a truck. Hey, Smitty, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
I'm great, but I'll get better, Smitty. What's on your mind?
Well, I just wanted to discuss George Jr.'s seeming impermeability, his bulletproofness. I think Karl Rove has been acting sort of as a bulletproof vest all these years.
Oh, yeah, he's been his brain ever since 73.
Well, more than just his brain. His ruthlessness, he's used Novak before.
Yeah.
Against Ann Richards.
Karl Rove used Novak against a guy who was competing with him for the direct mail business of George Bush's father during George Bush father's presidential campaign in 1980. And when Bush Sr. discovered that Rove had leaked bad information about his competitor for his mail order business to Bob Novak, Bush Sr. fired Karl Rove in 1980.
And that was the thing about the found bug? In his office?
No, that was another one. That was when Karl Rove was running the campaign of, I forget the guy's name, for governor of Texas. No, it wasn't. It might have been against Ann Richards, but Rove was running the Republican one. And
I thought he had leaked that to Robert Novak. But that's not,
No. He just called the newspaper and said, there's a bug in my office.
What I was suggesting is that now that Karl Rove seems down for the count, possibly, maybe Bush's remarkable luck. Maybe.
We'll go away. We can only hope, Smitty. We can only hope. Thanks for the call. Great to hear from you. Jesse, a Texas truck driver in Texas. There you go. All those T's. Hey, Jesse. We got about 15
Tom.
Seconds left. I'm sorry. We're running out of time. What's on your mind?
Oh, that's okay. I'll make this real quick, and then I'll get off. I'm not much of a conspirator theory and all that deal.
Yeah.
But if you get an explosives expert and have them look at them buildings or talk to one, that when them buildings went down, I think some of you guys are going to be mildly surprised by what you find out.
I have read the books and I've seen the videos, Jesse, and I'm as curious as anybody else. I tell you, especially Building 7, it's some serious open questions there. There's some serious open questions, and I appreciate you raising the issue. This is stuff that, in my mind, has not been well investigated. Coming up in the next hour, we're going to be talking with Evan Wolfson. Should gays marry? And we're going to, of course, we'll get back to Karl Rove and the war. And later on in the third hour of our program, monkey business. Should the Scopes monkey trial be revisited? That'll be a wild discussion. It's Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast on radio stations from California to Pennsylvania on the Sirius Satellite Radio, live on radiopower.org, whiterosesociety.org. Welcome back to our program. John Kennedy. I believe in an America that is officially neither Catholic, Protestant, nor Jewish, where no public official either requests or accepts instructions on public policy from the Pope, the National Council of Churches, or any other ecclesiastical source, where no religious body seeks to impose its will directly or indirectly upon the general populace or the public acts of its officials, and where religious liberty is so indivisible that an act against one church is treated as an act against all. The history of civil rights in this country, the 230-year history, arguably even longer than that, of civil rights in this country has been one of steady progression. Every generation having more rights, more freedoms, a better standard of living, higher quality of life than the generation that preceded them. And the conservatives now are hell-bent for leather on reversing that great tradition of America's. And Evan Wolfson is out there fighting the good fight. Evan's got a new book out called Why Marriage Matters, America, Equality, and Gay People's Right to Marry. And, Evan, you're one of the 100 most powerful and influential people in the world?
Well, that's what you read in Time magazine.
I'm impressed.
Oh, well, thank you.
your book raises, in fact, your chapter titles, it's just great, it raises the questions that are the talking points of the right. And I think it's just marvelous that you just take these things and bing, 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 let's go through them. Will allowing gay couples to marry harm society, Evan?
No, it will not. In fact, what people are seeing in Massachusetts, not to mention in Canada and Spain and Holland and Belgium, where marriage is now available, is that families are helped and no one's hurt when committed couples and their kids and their loved ones are able to take part in this institution. The more people are able to form relationships of caring for one another and have that relationship shored up and supported by the legal protections and responsibilities that come with marriage, the stronger a family they have and the stronger a community it builds for everybody.
I've always been baffled by that argument. You know, I've been married for 32 years, I think, 33 years, something like that.
Congratulations.
And I can't remember. My wife
it went by
right
so
now.
Fast.
There
right?
You go. It's been so much fun.
Yes.
And it actually has. After 20 years or so, it actually starts getting better. It always has, but anyhow, you don't need me pontificating about that. But my point is, if somebody that I knew got married, and you know, a gay couple that I knew got married, it wouldn't cause me to say, oh, gee, I think that I'll divorce my wife now. I mean, it's just, I don't get it. Where can you explain to me the logic of the cons who say that if gays are allowed to marry, it's going to harm the institution of marriage?
Well, no. I mean, it's the same kind of gloom and doom they've preached every time we've taken a step toward equality and inclusion in this country, whether it was allowing women to vote or ending slavery or allowing interracial marriage or allowing people to choose whether to leave a failed or abusive marriage rather than be forced to remain in a violent one. Again and again and again, they have said the sky is going to fall, and time again, it's been proven to be untrue. When you look at Massachusetts, polling shows a solid majority in Massachusetts supports marriage equality in that state because the people have had a chance to see it for real and not just have the hot button of right-wing rhetoric pushed over and over and over.
Yeah, I lived in Vermont up until just a few months ago and for the last decade. And I remember when gay marriage, well, it's not gay marriage there, it's civil unions, but, you know, close enough. And when civil unions came to Vermont, there was just this heated battle. I mean, it calls for the impeachment of the Supreme Court justices who had found it in the Constitution. And this whole you know, right-wing redneck movement erupted, and with these signs of "Take Back Vermont."
That's right.
And Ruth Dwyer out there, you know, leading the charge, running for governor as a Republican against Howard Dean, and there's what was funny was there's these Take Back Vermont signs all over Vermont. I mean, they were just, you know, in barns everywhere,
mm-hmm.
and people, a large part of Vermont's business is tourism, you know, a lot of their revenue, state revenue. People, tourists would come in and they'd see these signs and they thought, oh, isn't that sweet? They want us to buy some maple syrup and take it home.
Yeah, and so, in fact, that's exactly what's happened. Vermont actually got a financial windfall from people who supported the step toward equality.
That's right.
The Democrats and Republicans who voted for the bill have now largely come back into power in Vermont.
Most of them never left.
No, that's right. But there were a few candidates who took some heat, but that has now been changed. Just a few years later, nobody is pushing to overturn the law because
that's
people
right.
recognize it was a good thing. And in fact, in Massachusetts, people are seeing that the gays did not use up all the marriage licenses. There's still plenty of marriage for everyone to share, and it's better, not worse.
Yeah, okay. Now, what about the question, or what about the challenge, the suggestion that marriage is intended for procreation? It's that, you know, sex is about procreation. I mean, isn't this a variation on the kind of pseudo-Calvinist? Well, it's not even the Calvinist, the Puritan notion that sex is a bad thing.
Well, there are some people, right.
You toss
really
in a little bit of homophobia, you know.
Well, it's a combination, but some of the agenda of our opponents goes far beyond just the anti-gay stuff, though that's there, and really is about enforcing this procreative vision that they're not just objecting to marriage for gay people. They're objecting to legal contraception. They're objecting to the idea that women should have reproductive freedom and the ability to control their own bodies. And their agenda, as I said, goes well beyond the anti-gay position they're taking here. The fact of the matter is, everybody who gives it even just a moment of thought realizes that we don't have a procreation requirement for marriage, for couples getting married. There are many couples who are too old to have kids, who don't want to have kids, who may be on a second marriage and are choosing not to have kids, and they're given a marriage license. They're not issued a marriage license with a sunset provision where they have 2 years to cough up a child or lose the license. So why are we imposing a procreation requirement on committed gay couples who want to get married?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Bob and Elizabeth Dole are married, but they don't have kids. They're still married. Pat and Shelley Buchanan don't have kids. They're married. George and Martha Washington didn't have kids. They were married. There's just not, in fact, a procreation connection to marriage. But, you know, the flip side is also true, which is that there are many gay kids who are raising, many gay couples who are raising kids, and they want to have the protections and responsibilities that would strengthen their kids and give their kids full support. But those kids are being punished by not having their parents allowed to marry.
Right. And in some ways, the people who are putting forth this argument remind me of the logic of the Third Reich. I lived in Germany for a year, and there are people around. I mean, there's a couple hundred thousand of them. Some argue as many as a million, who are the Sonnenkinder. They are the children of the baby farms that Hitler had. He would find the fairest youth, the fairest women that he could find, the Aryan breeding stock, and they had hundreds of thousands of these women, and they were serviced by men who were in the SS, and you had to prove your Aryan ancestry to get into the SS, and it was just about producing as many babies as possible. And it's one of the reasons that Hitler waged a war against gays, or that was one of his rationales, was that he was concerned that the German people, there had to be more and more of them to outnumber all the other people in the area, because, you know, the old notion that whoever has the largest army wins. And here in the United States, there's the white supremacists are all about this. The Catholics are all about it's this kind of tribal racial identity thing. It's very weird.
Well, obviously not all Catholics subscribe to that kind of stuff. But some of the voices that were being heard in this debate today, again, are not just anti-gay. They are anti-Griswold versus Connecticut. That was the Supreme Court decision 40 years ago this year that struck down the law prohibiting even married couples from buying contraceptives, because the vision of some was that people had to be forced to marry and forced to procreate. But that's not part of American constitutional law. We believe in our country that marriage is not a union based on compulsion for the agenda of some religious group, but instead marriage is an important personal choice made by a committed couple willing to take on the rules and responsibilities, and they deserve equal legal treatment. And that applies to gay couples as well as to different sex couples.
We're talking with Evan Wilson, the author of Why Marriage Matters, America, Equality, and Gay People's Right to Marry, a book in support of marriage and gay marriage as well. Evan, what about how do you respond to critics who say, well, you know, come on, you guys, you can, why not just settle with a civil union? Why do you have to drag the word marriage into this? Isn't that a religious word?
Well, that's definitely a set of questions that people ask, and in fact, it's chapters 6 and 7 of Why Marriage Matters, because I think these are good questions that deserve good answers. The answer to the religious question is that there's a difference between the religious rites, R-I-T-E-S, of marriage that are up to every church, synagogue, temple, or mosque to decide for themselves without government interference, on the one hand, and the legal right, R-I-G-H-T, to marry, that is based on civil marriage licenses issued by the government. And religion should not be dictating who gets a civil marriage license from the government. You know, government doesn't issue baptism licenses or communion licenses, but it does issue marriage licenses because marriage is a legal institution that people enter into, many without ever setting foot in a church or synagogue. They get married by a judge or a clerk or even a captain at sea. And what we are talking about here is that legal institution of marriage that triggers this whole array of legal and economic, tangible and intangible duties and obligations and protections and support and dignity and clarity that make a real difference to families in every area of life, from birth to death, with taxes in between.
And in fact, the standards of religion for marriage are in some cases very different than civil standards. The Catholic Church, for example, says you can't divorce.
Well, that's right. And yet, on the other hand, nobody thinks it would be right for the cardinal to call over to the clerk's office and say, I want you to deny Catholic couples a civil marriage license.
Right.
The government can't call the cardinal and demand that divorced couples get married in the church, but the church should not be able to tell the clerk who gets the marriage license. And on the other hand, as you, I'm sure you also know, there are many religions and religious leaders and faiths in this country, as well as around the world, that in fact do support civil as well as religious marriage for same-sex couples. The United Church of Christ, one of the leading and mainline denominations in this country, just on July 4th this year, took a stand in support of marriage equality. Why should the government be taking sides on a religious question where religions differ?
Yeah, and finally, Evan Wilson, we have about a minute and a half left here.
Mm-hmm.
Tucker Carlson, always so glib and self-satisfied, is whenever this topic comes up, he says, okay, if you're in favor of gay marriage, you must also be in favor of bestiality and multiple marriages, polygamy. How do you respond to that?
Well, that's the same thing that the opponents of equality said back when we were fighting against interracial marriage bans. They said if we allow interracial couples to marry, it will lead to people marrying their dogs and polygamy and so on. And of course it didn't, because one thing has nothing to do with the other. Gay people are not saying, from now on we should have no rules and anything goes. What gay couples are saying is, let us have the same freedom to marry with the same rules, same responsibilities that our non-gay brothers and sisters have. Just like my brother is able to marry the person he loves, so I should be able to marry the person I love if we're willing to make a commitment and take on the rules that come with the institution.
What do you see as the future of gay marriage in the United States, Evan? It seems to me like this is just coming. You know, it's a tidal wave.
Well, not only is it coming, it's here. In fact, yeah. You know, couples have been getting married now for more than a year and a half in Massachusetts, and again, the sky has not fallen. There are other states that are going to follow. We're now in what I call, in Why Marriage Matters, the classic pattern of American civil rights advance, which is patchwork. And during these patchwork periods, some states move toward equality faster, while others resist and even regress. And there's a lot of agitation, but also a lot of important conversations person to person in which hearts and minds open. And I wrote Why Marriage Matters in order to help people make their voice heard in this important conversation.
Yeah, and I think it is a very important conversation. It's one that the right is going to try and demagogue to death, and we need to be informed and have our talking points to rebut them.
Well, that's right. And this, you know, the values here are love, commitment, fairness, and freedom. These are American values, and that's what's at stake here.
There you go. Evan Wilson, the book Why Marriage Matters. Evan, thanks a lot for being with us
today.
Thank you. Keep up the good work. Spread the word. America, equality, and gay people's rights to marry. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Our telephone number, 866-889-8894, tomhartman.com. Our URL, if you want to drop into the chat room, live chat room, just click live chat. It's 20 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Searching for how to look in the mail, never fail in the mail, yet it come around here.
Welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. Ellen Ratner is with us, our bureau chief from Washington, D.C. Hey, Ellen, how's it going in the belly of the beast?
Well, the belly of the beast is pretty interesting today. Mr. Chertoff, who's Homeland Security, said that...
Also known as the Beast.
Right. Said that the state and local governments should help to defray their costs or pay for their costs for security. He said... The reason he's saying this is that aviation is almost always a federal, you know, federal regulated thing, right, where transit systems operate their own local governments. Now, go figure on that one.
So he's saying, what's happened is that the TSA budget is bigger than the FBI budget.
Right, but TSA doesn't have the money to help local transportation.
Right, but I mean, they're spending more money frisking granny at the airport, as Earl Blumenauer puts it, than we're spending on the entire budget of the FBI. And he wants to keep doing that, and it's just, yeah, okay, got
it. Exactly. Let me go to a couple other things here. And that is the GAO, you know them, the Government Accounting Office, which is the research and congressional arm of an oversight arm of spending of Congress, says the Defense Department has been very difficult and is not cooperating in trying to give them the statistics they need for the spending of the war in Iraq. He called it, the Comptroller General said that it was an atrocious accounting. They're trying to issue reports on how the supplemental was spent, on how construction is spent, and the per-soldier cost, and they said the Pentagon is totally not being cooperative. Meanwhile, back at home, they are trying to add in the Senate, I believe, an attachment to the bill. I think it's, which bill is coming through, Greg, now? We're just checking that out. To take away robe security clearance. And today, at 3 p.m., they are, Senator Schumer and Ambassador Joseph Wilson are having a media meeting, a press conference, to talk about how the White House should suspend the Chief of Staff, Deputy Chief of Staff, robes security clearance while the investigation is pending and until the Valerie Plame, leak is resolved. And Schumer and Wilson are going to be calling for a suspension of robes security clearance.
The big question in my mind about this whole thing with Rove and Valerie Plame is, who told Karl Rove that Valerie Plame works for the FBI?
Well, that's now the right, and you know I do a lot of right-wing radio shows, Tom,
right,
is claiming that it came from a reporter and that it didn't come from the White House's security apparatus at all. The other thing is, if you go into Wikipedia and you look up Watergate, you see that it's not necessarily that Karl Rove, that what really got Watergate was the cover-up, the using government authority to try and blame somebody, and the first lie. And I think what's going to get Rove is not the fact that he may have inadvertently said her name, but that he may have lied about it.
Inadvertently, Ellen?
Well, you know what I'm saying. That's what they're going to claim. They're going to claim inadvertently. That's what they're going to claim. So, but I think a cousin of mine is a lawyer for white-collar criminals, and she says what always gets them in trouble is their first lie.
Yeah, yeah. So it's like the logic that Karl Rove has been using, or Ken Melman has been using in his defense of Karl Rove, is that he didn't name her name. It's like a mafia boss says to one of his hitmen, go kill Mrs. Johnson, or go kill Joe Johnson's wife. You know, he doesn't name her name, and then he tries to go into court and say, I didn't order the murder of that woman. I didn't name her. You know?
Exactly.
Come on, give me a break. So anyhow, so this is going to continue to spin out and play out, and we'll see how it goes. And the right wing is trying now to elevate Karl Rove into the status of whistleblower, and it's going to be amazing to watch this. It's the new drama. Hopefully this will replace Michael Jackson and the Runaway Bride.
Well, we just found they want to attach it to the Homeland Security funding.
Aha! Uh-huh. Okay, great. Ellen Ratner, thanks a lot for the report from Washington, D.C. Much appreciated.
Thank you.
Ellen Ratner, it's 29 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Harbin.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
PBS's budget will be zero. Watch the Congress pluck our TV hero. Pack up all those feathered clothes. Hit the road, pointy nose. Bye, bye, Big Bird. PBS, what a commie quad. Liberal show, that's all they got. Left-wing Big Bird.
Oh, but they're going to turn it into the Corporation for Republican Broadcasting.
Bert and Ernie finally can get married. We know every puppet trick.
I love you.
Gee, that's sick. Barney, bye-bye.
Oh, my. Well, hopefully not. I think the Corporation for Public Broadcasting does a lot of good in the United States. The McNeil-Lehrer reports about the last place it left in America where you can actually get news. Other than this program, of course. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number here on the Tom Hartman Program, where being progressive never felt so good, where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. Part of the plot, Linda in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Linda, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Hey, I just wanted to call you because I called the Republican National Committee yesterday.
Oh, you're kidding. Washington, D.C.?
Yeah, well, after reading their talking points, and they're trying to make this into a partisan thing with Karl Rove and Joe Wilson, you know?
Yeah.
And it made a big deal about Joe Wilson contributing to the Kerry campaign, blah, blah, blah. Well, I asked them if they knew that Joe Wilson had contributed to the Bush campaign in 2000, and he said that in his book. Mm-hmm. And the reason that he switched over was when the Bush administration started distorting all this stuff about Iraq.
And what did they say?
Oh, I got a big silence, and then she said, well, do you want somebody to call you back? And I said, sure, but nobody ever did.
Yeah, do you want somebody to call you back? Amazing. So you called the RNC. I am impressed, Linda. That's
Well, the phone number's right on the bottom of their talking points.
Would you happen to have that available?
Well, I can't remember where I got it from, but it's on the Internet.
Okay. Yeah. In fact, I had their talking points on my computer yesterday. Let me see if I've got... here I have their talking points. And we clipped it off. Oh, here it is.
Yeah, down at the bottom of the page.
Republican senators defend Karl Rove. Contact Tracy Schmidt, 202-863-8614. And I'm not sure, though. This is, for immediate release. Yeah, so, I'm not sure if that's the RNC or if that's just a PR firm.
Oh, yeah. Well, the phone number I called was the RNC.
Yeah, that probably
and
is.
And it was just interesting because, it's not a partisan thing. What we want is the truth here.
Yeah. Yeah. All we'd like is the truth. Linda, thanks for the call.
Okay.
Thank you for, I salute you. I think that's great. Elizabeth Dole, quote, the partisan attacks against Karl Rove are out of control and entirely. The partisan attacks? The partisan attack, to call out somebody for an act of treason is partisan? I mean, wasn't it George W. Bush who said that this is not a good thing, that he's going to fire whoever did this if he finds them? Wasn't it George Herbert Walker Bush who said that this is the worst form of treason? Of course, George W. Bush, he's kind of rewritten things. I guess he kind of rewrites the rules as he goes along, It's...
If it feels good, do it. And if you got a problem, blame it on somebody else.
The official philosophy of this administration. Actually, that's not their official philosophy. This is their official philosophy.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
Yeah. So the Karl Rove... mess, shall we say. There are some details of this that I think a lot of people are unfamiliar with, and it's really worth noting. First of all, Massachusetts Representative John Tierney yesterday announced that all the Democrats in the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence sent a letter to George W. Bush. Hey, Mr. President! Of course, it'll be considered partisan because it was all the Democrats. We think Karl Rove's security clearance should be pulled. Now, you know, I'm of the American persuasion, not of the Democratic or Republican persuasion. Although those of you who have listened to the program for long know that I think that probably taking over and taking back the Democratic Party is the best hope for America. I am also an advocate of taking over and taking back the Republican Party for those people who are so inclined to be Republicans. You know, I would love to see the Republican Party being run by ethical, responsible Republicans. People, you know, people like I knew when I was growing up. Dwight Eisenhower type Republican, bring them back. Folks like my parents, who are still Republicans. I mean, there's a few Republicans out there that are decent, but this party, you know, this has been taken over by right-wing nutcases, and they've been doing their best to force them out. So there's that. Rove's War. Sidney Blumenthal wrote a great piece for Salon.com, and in it, called Rove's War, and in it he points out that the war in Iraq is Karl Rove's War. And not only is the war in Iraq Karl Rove's War, but the whole Rove War about Karl Rove is Rove's War. Now, Sidney Blumenthal doesn't get into the whole thing about the war in Iraq being Rove's War as much as he does, suggesting simply that Rove's War right now is a war for survival. But he's going on the attack. He's marshaling the forces. It may seem to you like Newt and all these other people, they're just, you know, spontaneously coming forward to protect and defend Karl Rove. I'm telling you, Karl Rove is the puppet master. He's the guy who's orchestrating his own defense in the circles of public relations. Valerie Plame's superiors asked her to cable the field in Africa, he notes, for routine approval of an investigation of the Niger claim. At Langley, Wilson met with about a dozen officers to discuss the situation. Plame was not at the meeting. Afterward, Wilson informed his wife that he would be traveling to Niger for about 10 days. She was not particularly enthusiastic, having recently given birth to twins, but she understood the importance of the mission. She had no authority to commission him. She was simply not the responsible senior officer, nor, if she had been, could she have done so unilaterally. There was nothing of value to be gained personally from the mission by either Joe or Valerie Wilson. He undertook the trip out of a long, ingrained sense of government service, and I would add, patriotism. I mean, this had nothing to do with his wife. When the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence put together a report on why did the Iraq War happen? Why did we get ourselves in a war based on phony intelligence? How could it be that we get over to Iraq and discover that the whole reason why we're there, the weapons of mass destruction, the chemical, biological, and atomic agents that George Bush had told us were going to be there, that they weren't there? How could it be, we asked, that they weren't there? As George Bush had said,
first I'm asked why Iraq is different from other countries or regimes that also have terrible weapons. While there are many dangers in the world, the threat from Iraq stands alone because it gathers the most serious dangers of our age in one place.
So you get it. This is George W. Bush telling us, you know, Iraq's got all... So the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence looks into this thing and says, you know, how did this thing happen? And they concluded that the report by... They also issued a second report on political pressure on the intelligence process. That report has never seen the light of day. The Republicans who control the committee quashed it. The ranking Republicans put a three-page addendum on their report. They just added this thing on, in which they say, quote, the plan to send the former ambassador to Niger was suggested by the former ambassador's wife, a CIA employee, end quote. This is what the Republicans on the Senate Intelligence Committee said in their amendment to the report. It is a lie. Plain old, flat out, it is a lie. The CIA subsequently issued a statement, as reported by New York Newsday and CNN, that the Republican senator's conclusion about Plame's role was a lie, was wholly inaccurate. Oddly, the Washington Post just quoted the Republican senators. But, you know, CNN actually reported that the CIA issued a statement in which they said, sorry, the Republican senators are wrong. Here you're seeing a war. Now, this is not a good thing for the CIA to be at war with a political party. But they're fighting for their survival. I mean, this is a major disaster for the CIA. CIA spokesman Bill Harlow told Wilson, Joe Wilson, that the Republican Senate staff never contacted him for the agency's information on that matter. Right? In other words, they come to this conclusion. The Republicans on the House Select Committee on Intelligence, they come to this conclusion that Valerie Plame sent Joe Wilson to Niger. Didn't even bother to ask anybody at the CIA who could have told them that she did not do that. She didn't have the authority to ask him to go. She didn't recommend him. And in fact, she was opposed to his going. She had just had twins, and she wanted her husband to stay home. In fact, the only document cited as the basis for Plame's role was a State Department memo that was later debunked by the CIA. The Bush State Department. Colin Powell's State Department. Now Condi Rice's State Department. The woman who has an oil tanker named after her, you'll recall. Even more curious, notes Salon, this article by Sidney Blumenthal, even more curious, one of the outlets where the document was circulated was Talon News Service and its star correspondent Jeff Gannon. So here we have Jeff Gannon, the source of this story that is being quoted now by, what, Newt Gingrich on Fox News? And then you got Rove saying, you got Ken Melman coming out and saying, no, Rove didn't reveal her name. Therefore, it's not a crime. Well, the law says all you have to do is reveal someone's identity, and it's a crime. In fact, CNN, Wolf Blitzer, talking to Ken Melman. Melman is trying to defend Karl Rove, right? Karl Rove has sent Ken Melman out and said, you go defend me. You do the circuit. You know, we don't care if you end up looking like an idiot. This is about Karl Rove. And so Wolf Blitzer says to Melman, have you attended any meetings at the White House about how to deal with Joe Wilson? And all of a sudden, Ken Melman, who loves to talk in paragraphs, just clams up. I don't recall those meetings occurring. Meetings? It makes you wonder if the prosecutor has asked, you know, what's going on with this. This case, he said, it's not about a whistleblower. This from Fitzpatrick, the prosecutor in this case. Fitzpatrick, he says, this case is not about a whistleblower. It's about a potential retaliation against a whistleblower. Joe Wilson was the whistleblower. The retaliant was Karl Rove. Steve in Atlanta, downtown Atlanta on the line. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, what is your source for... See, I've been going... That's so fascinating. You were talking about this. I've been going round and round on a blog about this with a guy, and he posted that Washington Post article that you just cited that says that Valerie Plame wanted Wilson to go.
Right, and it's a lie.
And so, yeah, what is your source for saying...
Sidney Blumenthal's column in Salon today. Salon.com. It's called Rove's War.
Blumenthal's
Sidney Blumenthal.
Guy. You know, this brings up, you know, talking about all this, partisan attack bullcrap, it's bringing up an issue with me that is just clear that all these fundamentalist right-wingers, you know, Republicans, whatever, are putting their party before their country.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just fascinating, and I remember even going around.
It's not even their party, I got to say, Steve, because I think they're willing to destroy the Republican Party as well. They're putting their personal power and their personal status and their personal access to wealth and the levers of power ahead of everything, including other people within their party.
No, I'm not talking about people in power. I'm talking about all my Republican friends out there that I debate with, you know, the ones that just, you know, raise their fur on their back whenever they hear me talking bad about the party, and they just try to think of any way to defend it. I'm like, come on, you know, right is right, wrong is wrong. Yeah. It was like I told this one guy, when, you know, before the Bush-Kerry election, I was pointing out all the stuff that's Bush doing wrong, and he said, well, what's Kerry going to do about it? And I said, you're missing the point.
Yeah.
You've got to take a stand when it comes to your party and say, look, I'm not going to put up with this. You're out. You know
what's amazing is when Bill Clinton was caught in a lie about mm-hmm. sex, which in my opinion was frankly between him and his wife.
Right.
But when he was caught in a lie about sex, Democrats came out and condemned him. Al Gore wouldn't talk to him for a couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. Al Gore didn't want him campaigning with him. And it wasn't that he didn't, Al Gore knew that having Bill Clinton campaign with him would actually help his campaign. But Al Gore was horrified by the fact that Bill Clinton had lied to the American people. Democrats condemned him. Democrats of integrity stood up and said, what Bill Clinton did was wrong. And they were honest. Yeah, they were honest about it. And where are the Republicans of integrity?
I don't know. I mean, I'm joining the Democratic Party here, but I'm not going to just vote for any Democrat just because they're a Democrat. If they're, for example, our representative really pushed, he's a Democrat, really pushed for this $300,000 medical liability thing.
Yeah.
I'm not putting up with that.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, you lost my vote,
Yeah.
And more people need to stick to their principles.
Yeah, and the main thing is you need to make sure that person, I wouldn't tell him that he'd entirely lost your vote, but you need to, lean on them really hard. If you tell them they've lost your vote, then they don't take you seriously. At that point, they write you off. And that's a normal and human reaction. But and I'm reluctant to blow anybody off based on one issue, but I think that it's important that we keep the pressure on continuously and keep these guys honest. Steve, sure. Thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. It's the Tom Hartman Program, 10 minutes before the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Third time I've said that. I'll probably say it three more times. See, in my line of work, you got to keep repeating things over and over and over again for the truth to sink in, to kind of catapult the propaganda.
You gave them the old razzle-dazzle. You razzle-dazzled them.
Oh, he did so well.
You gave them an act with lots of flash in it. Made them believe you were compassionate.
Oh, a compassionate conservative.
The old hocus-pocus. You misdirected them. With 9/11 and Saddam Hussein. You played them both right to perfection. Despite the fact there's no connection, you razzle-dazzled them, let those blue states complain.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
Yeah. George W. Bush. Oh, my, oh, my, oh, my. Yeah, George W. Bush.
We're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
Now we discover that the first part was a lie, and the second part apparently was true. He had already decided that he was going to go to Iraq. And now we have Joe Wilson this morning on the Today Show calling for the resignation, calling for the firing of Karl Rove, the senior administration official who outed a CIA agent.
And I don't know if we're going to find out. The senior administration official. Now, this is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
Doesn't have any idea. I'm telling you, this is coming back on. Now they're going to start blaming Matt Cooper. You get this from the Think Progress blog. Byron York just published an article based on an interview with Rove's lawyer, Robert Luskin. A new step in the Rove spin machine. Their new take, it's all Matt Cooper's fault. I'm not kidding you. It's all Matt Cooper's fault. It's Time Magazine. It's all about Time Magazine. Luskin told NRO that Rove is not hiding behind the defense that he did not identify Wilson's wife because he did not specifically use her name. Instead, if that argument was too legalistic, Luskin said, I agree with you. I think it's a detail. And he says, it's just incredible. It's all They're gonna try and pin this now. Just watch. They tried to pin it on Valerie Plame. Now they're gonna try and pin it on Matt Cooper. It's, you know, pin the tail on the donkey time at the Republican National Committee, and this administration. We'll see how long they can last. I'm Tom Hartman. Exposing the con in conservative.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 7 minutes past the hour. John Perry is the author of a new book, the co-author, actually, along with Marvin Alasky, Monkey Business, the true star story of the Scopes trial. John, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Hello, Tom. Thank you.
Glad to have you here. John, I understand down in Arkansas there is a Hindu family who is lobbying to have my Christian tax dollars spent to promote the idea in our public schools that the universe is 5 billion years old and grew out of the navel of a god on a lotus blossom. Do you think that creation myths of any specific religion should be taught in our public schools?
I don't think that the public schools are a place to promote myths under any circumstances unless you identify them as such.
Okay, so why is it then, in reading your book, and I spent a few hours with it last night, that I get the strong sense that you're in favor of creation science being taught, that the world is only 6,000 years old in our schools?
Because I think it is a credible answer to the question of where we came from and how we got here. It certainly is not the only answer, the only possible answer, but neither is evolution.
But if you're going to teach your interpretation of one of many interpretations of the modern variation of the Christian creation myth, why not teach the Hindu creation myth? Why not teach the Lakota Sioux creation myth? Why not talk about the great turtle?
I think I missed the great turtle, actually. I don't think I found that one.
Well, there's a Native American tribe that believes that there was this giant turtle on the back of which the world is carried across the sky and all that sort of thing. And the great turtle has been around for hundreds of generations, presumably millions of years. Who knows? Maybe they only say 5 or 6,000 years. You Google creation myths. I mean, there's literally hundreds of them. Every human culture in history has its own unique creation myth. Why should our Christian creation myth be the one that's taught in school alongside evolution?
Because first of all, I think there's compelling scientific evidence that supports the creationist view that Christians promote. Second of all, I think it's a fundamental component of our whole culture and our whole legal system and everything else that makes America what it is.
Well, how is the Christian creation story a part of our legal system? You've lost me there, John.
Well, the Christian legal, rather the America's legal system, is founded on basic Judeo-Christian fundamentals that are from the Bible, and among those fundamentals is the story of creation.
And now, I still don't get it. How is it that the story of creation has anything to do with our laws?
The story of creation is a part of the Judeo-Christian tradition that our country was founded on.
And, I don't find it in any of our laws.
You don't find the Judeo-Christian tradition in our laws?
Well, in fact, Thomas Jefferson wrote to Benjamin Rush a rather detailed rebuttal of that. He pointed out that that our law was founded in British common law, and British common law went back to the year 400 when the Romans left and the Saxons took over, the Anglo-Saxons, and Christianity wasn't introduced into the UK until the 600s, around 650. So there was 250 years where there was no Christianity, but there were laws, and our laws are grounded in that.
Well, I think it's also
he referred to the frauds of the clergy, to quote Thomas Jefferson.
Well, I think it's also true that Jefferson wrote in the letter that the God who gave us life gave us liberty at the same time. The hand of force can destroy, but cannot disjoin them.
Yeah. What does that have to do with
the law? What that says is that the Creator God gave us life. It didn't come from a turtle. It didn't come from somebody's navel, according to Thomas Jefferson.
Uh-huh. And therefore, our laws are based on this, that we should go before priests to determine if somebody is guilty or innocent of a crime, for example?
Well, no, that's not true. And in fact, the Bible makes a strong distinction between the job that a priest has and the job that a lawmaker has.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how much you read the Bible, but I believe it's true.
I have read it from cover to cover 4 times.
Well, you're ahead of me then, but I believe it's true that there were these tribes of Israel, and there was one tribe that all the priests were from, another tribe that all the lawmakers from, the kings were from. And so very early on in the process, the Judeo-Christian God separated the rulers from the priests. So I don't think Jefferson or anybody else is arguing that the priests should run our country and the priests should make our laws. That's I don't think that's his argument at all. That's certainly not my argument.
But your argument is that, first of all, you're saying that our legal system is grounded in Christianity, and
yes.
I'm saying it's not. Our legal system is grounded in the British legal system, which was grounded actually in paganism.
Well, if you look at
there is no religion in the world that does not, there is no culture in the world, regardless of religion, that does not say don't steal and don't murder. And those are the only two of the Ten Commandments that we have actually enacted into law. I mean, my children can diss me, and I cannot stone them to death like the Bible says I should do. It's not part of our law. If somebody can worship another god, I can't stone them to death like the Bible says I should. If I see somebody working on Saturday, I can't kill them like the Bible says I should. None of those things have made their way into our law. Only not stealing and not killing have made their way into our law. How can you say that our law is based on biblical tradition?
Well, if you look at the comparison between the writing of our founders and the writing of great British jurists like, say, William Blackstone, you'll see that there's a very strong similarity. They were great students of Blackstone. And then if you go back to Blackstone, you'll see that he draws his legal inference and his ideas directly from Christian teaching and from the Bible in particular.
Well, Blackstone was not necessarily a friend. Here's February 10th, 1814, a letter to Dr. Thomas Cooper from Thomas Jefferson, and I quote, "Finally, in answer to Fortescue Ablund's question why the Ten Commandments should not now be part of the common law of England, we may say they are not because they never were. Anybody who asserted that the Ten Commandments were the basis of American or British law was believing a document that is a manifest forgery. British common law existed before Christianity arrived in England. Sir Matthew Hale lays it down in these words, Christianity is parcel of the laws of England. But Christianity was not introduced until the 7th century, the conversion of the first Christian king of the Heptarchy having taken place around the year 598, and that of the last around 686. Here, then, is a space of 200 years during which the common law was in existence and Christianity no part of it. We might as well say that the Newtonian system of philosophy is a part of the common law as that the Christian religion is," said Thomas Jefferson. In truth, he says, the allegiance between church and state in England has ever made their judges accomplices in the frauds of the clergy, and even bolder than that they are.
I don't think anybody's arguing for the fact that the clergy should run the country. In fact, in countries where the clergy are officially appointed, that's where faith seems to be the weakest. If you look at countries like Germany or like England, like the Scandinavian countries where the clergy are civil servants, that's where...
I'm responding to your assertion that our law is based in Christianity. Here again, Thomas Jefferson, January 24th, 1814, a letter to John Adams. He said, and I quote, It is not only the sacred volumes the churches have thus interpolated, gutted, and falsified, but the works of others relating to them and even the laws of the land. Our judges, too, have lent a ready hand to further these frauds and have been willing to lay the yoke of their own opinions on the necks of others, to extend the coercions of municipal law to the dogmas of their religion by declaring that these make a part of the law of the land. End quote.
In the Declaration of Independence, Jefferson wrote that they gave a justification for their separation from the English king, and the reason was that the king was usurping rights that Americans had that were endowed by their creator.
I'm assuming that you're familiar with the debate between Jefferson and Adams when the Declaration was written?
I've read some of that background. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Thomas Jefferson wrote, you know, when in the course of human events, the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and nature's God entitle them. And John Adams said it should be the Christian God. And Thomas Jefferson said, no, it's nature's God.
Right.
And not only that, the word God does not exist in our Constitution. We have a godless Constitution. Intentionally.
You're right. You're right. And you're exactly right. It doesn't appear, and it's for the very reason that you say they don't want to compel people to believe a certain way.
Right. So what baffles me is why you would want to compel our children to believe a certain way in our public school systems with our tax dollars.
That's not my proposal at all.
You're suggesting that creationism should be taught in our schools. Creationism is derived from the creation myth of one particular religion, the one that you and I share, Christianity. And you're suggesting that that should be taught to our school students, and that somebody who believes that the great turtle created the world, or somebody who believes that, there's fairly good science backing up the Hindu creation myth. That creation myth actually includes 5 billion years, and, you know, there's, quote, evidence, if you want to use that word, and there's Hindus out there saying, hey, our creation myth is the best creation myth, because it's actually, you know, it's got eras and yugas and all this stuff. We're in the Kali Yuga, or coming into it. Why should they have to pay with their tax dollars for their children to learn the creation myth that you and I share?
Well, first of all, they don't.
But that's what you're suggesting.
What I'm suggesting is that Christianity should be that the creation story should be presented as a credible alternative to evolution theory.
Why?
Because it is a credible alternative.
But, you know, so is the great turtle.
Well,
so is, we'll leave aside the great turtle. So is the Hindu creation story that says that the universe came out of the mind, you know, that essentially, you know, some being thought, and that created some kind of motion. And the metaphor, of course, is the lotus coming out of the navel of whichever god it was. And everything came into being, and there have been all these eras, and they basically define stuff that coincides with science, oddly enough.
Well, now you see, I'm not sure I understand that, because I understand where some of the Christian creation story coincides with scientific developments or scientific ideas, but I don't know that any of these other things you're suggesting do.
I'm guessing you haven't studied them. You're suggesting, though, that it's going to do our children well, that it's going to serve them well if they believe that this universe is 5 to 6,000 years old.
No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that we owe it to our children to teach the fact that creation science is not a slam dunk. I mean that evolution theory is not a slam dunk. That we have to teach them that there are holes in evolution theory, that it's not a done deal, and that I think we owe it to them to teach them the truth, which is there's some honest controversy.
But obviously that's being taught. I mean, when I studied biology in high school and college, it was just about the time that Stephen Jay Gould came out with this concept of punctuated evolution, which contradicts Darwin. I'm sure you're familiar with that.
Well, that's the whole argument, as I understand it, is that the school districts now are compelled not to teach anything except that evolution is the absolute truth.
I don't believe that.
That's part of the controversy in Kansas. That was part of the controversy in Atlanta a while back, and they were putting stickers in the textbooks in Texas and other places. My understanding is that was the controversy, that they were being compelled to teach evolution theory alone as a slam dunk.
In the science class, they're teaching science. In a religion class, if we're going to have a comparative religion class, let's talk about the creation myth of Christians and the creation myth of the Hindus and the great turtle and all these things. Why not?
Well, that's fine, but my point is...
But you want this stuff taught as science.
Well, my point is, and the point of the book is, that the evolution theory alone does not explain life as we see it.
Okay. John Perry, you defend your position well. I salute you. The book is called The Monkey Business, The True Story of the Scopes Trial, and that's a fascinating story in and of itself, Scopes Monkey Trial, and William Jennings Bryan. Brian and what he was all up to. Anyhow, John, thanks so much for being with us today.
Tom, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
I appreciate it. It's the Tom Hartman Program, 20 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
We've seen it all before. We know what it's all about. He lied to get us into war. He'll lie to get us out. Fool us one more time, like no one's keeping score. Election fraud should be a crime. Don't let them do it anymore. Coup d'etat, oh coup d'etat. Here we go again.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 25 minutes past the hour. Thomas Jefferson in his letter to... where'd it go? Oh, there it is. Major John Cartwright, June 5th, 1824. Quote, our revolution commenced on more favorable grounds than the foundation of English or biblical law. It presented us an album on which we were free to write what we pleased. We had no occasion to search into musty records, to hunt up royal parchments, or to investigate the laws and institutions of a semi-barbarous ancestry. We appealed to those of nature and found them engraved on our hearts. Writing to Cartwright, he says, I was glad to find in your book a formal contradiction at length of the judiciary usurpation of legislative powers, for such the judges have usurped in their repeated decisions that Christianity is a part of the common law. The proof of the contrary, which you have adduced, is incontrovertible. To wit, that the common law existed while the Anglo-Saxons were yet pagans, at a time when they had never heard the name of Christ pronounced or knew that some such a character ever existed. But it may amuse you to show when and by what means they stole this law in upon us. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. That issue, Karl Rove and others on the table today. Lots going on. Amy in San Diego on the line. Hey, Amy, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to respond to that caller you were just talking creationism and evolution, and I am a Christian, and it just bugs me to death that they think that some people think that creationism and evolution cannot work together, and they absolutely do. I believe that, you know, God created everything that we had, but we have no idea what the timeline was. It says in the Bible that to God a day could be 1,000 years.
Yeah, and it doesn't say 6,000 years in the Bible.
Right. But there's lots of places in the Bible where they get the numbers wrong. They're conflicting in different places. Like one place that says, you know, Noah's Ark had two animals, and one place that it says he had four.
Well, there's two different creation stories in Genesis.
Yeah,
the first
right.
two chapters of Genesis right. contradict each other. But the second and third chapter, rather. But the point is that,
yeah.
it, for me, is that it is an unchristian thing to do, if
Absolutely.
You want to get about it, to say that government money should be used to promote religion, because they, you know, they came to Jesus and said, what should I do with this coin? You know, should
Give
I pay my taxes?
Caesar. Right.
And he says, whose picture's on it? And the guy says,
right.
Caesar's. And he says, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's,
Absolutely.
And unto God what is God's. And in my opinion, somebody who comes along and says, okay, we're going to take religion and we're going to use the power of the state to enforce it, is going against the teachings of Jesus, not with.
Absolutely. I totally agree with you. Thanks, Tom, for
sure.
letting me speak.
Sure. You're welcome, Amy. Thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Jeff in Denver on the line. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hi. Dealing with the whole thing of the Hindu creation myth and science, it's interesting after spending time both studying various religions, you know, meditating for many years and so forth, and having a scientific background, I'm constantly amazed at how much the Hindu creation myth starts to have a lot of basis. I mean, a
yeah.
lot of agreement with cosmology in general, you know, the deep physics.
It does, and the Maharishi people are really good at pointing that out, but, you know, it's still a creation myth.
Yes, exactly.
like,
and
I don't think it should be taught in our public schools unless it's
exactly,
taught in a comparative
yep.
religion class.
And what we end up with is this whole area of I would call soft science, you know, where it really is untestable by our current scientific means, and we just leave it at that. We have to be satisfied that we cannot prove this stuff, and we just...
We still don't know what electricity is. Yeah. I mean, you know, we don't know how aspirin works. We're starting to get some inclinations on aspirin, at least. But we still don't know what electricity is. I mean, just because you don't know all the details of something doesn't mean that it is discredited. It doesn't mean that you should just throw the thing out and say, oh, no, there's some holes in this theory of electricity. Therefore, let's not use electricity anymore. Let's not teach about Ohm's law in school. Let's just teach that when sparks fly from the sky to the ground, that's not electricity. That's an angry creator, upset, throwing lightning. But it's Thor. Zeus. It's Zeus. He's throwing lightning bolts down. You know, come on. It's like, well, enough of that. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 1-866-889-8894. Be right back with your calls, 29 minutes past the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
There is no doubt we're running out of our petroleum. In 30 years it disappears, and that is worrisome. So we send the fleet, but drag our feet on renewable energy. Cause God forbid our friends in Texas lose their monopoly. Though solar power would not pollute our water, air, and soil. We'd rather send our troops to war than lose a single drop of oil. We got four more years. We just won a majority.
Only three. Now, well, three and a half. Yeah, oh, it's going to be a tough one, isn't it? Isn't it? Oh, my goodness. In the chat room, Hobgod says, "Hey, Tom, Rod Parsley states our founding fathers clearly meant religious faith to be an integral part of public life because of the foundation of faith they set for us. We have chaplains in the military, in Congress, and in federal prisons." Interesting. I would say that the chaplains are not there to enforce faith. They're there to make it available. And secondly, some of the founders clearly were very, very religious people as well as spiritual people. I would say that Thomas Jefferson, Ben Franklin, George Washington, James Madison were all very spiritual people. But all of them, all four of those men, clearly would not define themselves as Christians and were outspoken in their opposition to religion. Well, James Madison actually probably called himself a Christian, but the other three were deists, clearly deists. And we just need to acknowledge that. But the thing is that these are like the big names of the founders. I mean, instead of quoting, who wants to quote John Mason or George Mason? I mean, who wants to quote John Jay? It's not as sexy a name as Thomas Jefferson or George Washington. And so, you know, they all want to quote George Washington. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that wasn't Washington's, that wasn't his thing. I mean, you know, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, in his personal diary on February 1st, 1799, wrote to, in his personal diary, this wasn't published until after he died, Thomas Jefferson, writing in his own diary, he says, on the topic of Washington's religious sentiments, he says, when the clergy addressed General Washington on his departure from the government, it was observed in their consultation that he had never, on any occasion, said a word to the public which showed a belief in the Christian religion. And they thought that he should so pen their address as to force him at length to publicly declare whether or not he was a Christian. They did so. However, the old fox was too cunning for them. He answered every article of their address particularly, except that, which he passed over without notice. Washington never did say a word on the subject in any of his public papers. I'm still quoting from Thomas Jefferson. Washington never did say a word on the subject in any of his public papers, except in his valedictory letter to the governors of the states when he resigned his commission in the army, wherein he speaks of the benign influence of the Christian religion. I know that Governor Morris, who pretended to be in his secrets, in Washington's confidence, and believed himself to be so, has often told me that General Washington believed no more of that fundamentalist Christian system than he himself did. End of quote. Thomas Jefferson, personal diary, February 1, 1799. In fact, George Washington supervised the language of a treaty with African Muslims, the Treaty of Tripoli. It was signed into law by John Adams in 1797 that starts out, quote, as the government of the United States of America is not in any sense founded on the Christian religion, and as it has in itself no character or of enmity against the laws, religion, or tranquility of the Muslimmen, and as the Muslims, and as the said states never have entered into any war or act of hostility against any Mohammedan nation, It is declared by the parties that no pretext arising from religious opinions shall ever produce an interruption of the harmony existing between the two countries. End quote. Of course, tell that to George W. Bush. Well, you know, enough of that. I think we kind of beat that one into the ground. We'll come back to it if necessary. But larger import right now, Karl Rove trying to rescue himself. And will he bring down George W. Bush with him? Is it possible for Karl Rove to come down without George Bush coming down with him, since the two have been joined at the hip since 1973 when Karl Rove first fell in love with George W. Bush? Is it possible? 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Dave in Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, Dave, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Yeah, well, I think George Bush will bring himself down. I mean, you can only fool people for so long, 2 or 3 years, without a lot of help. But you had a caller earlier today that suggested that the country was going brain dead. I think that's a little harsh, for sure. But you have to admit that Bush's mindset of fear, mistrust, greed, they have lowered the consciousness and the awareness of the country as a whole.
Yes, between and the fact that our news services no longer have to provide news in the context of public service because of changes in the law, both by Reagan and by Clinton. And as a result of that, now we are fed a daily supply of infotainment rather than information. And well, you combine those two things, that and a very, very successful propaganda apparatus coming out of this administration, and yeah, you've got a lot of misinformed Americans.
But if you think back to the Clinton era, you know, say what you want about his personal life, there was a coming together of this country and really of the world under Clinton that was new. It was a new feeling to a lot of people. I've talked to a lot of people that feel the same way.
Yeah.
There was just a sharing of information and a pretty good feeling about everything and the way things were going, whether you liked Clinton or not. You really couldn't question the effectiveness of what was going on. And we've lost that. There are leaders around this country. When Bill Clinton hugged somebody, you knew it was real. The camera didn't lie. I saw it, you saw it, and other leaders in this world saw it, and they wanted to do business with us. They don't want to do business with us anymore. I was listening to the Prime Minister of Singapore on an interview with Charlie Rose last night. They're distraught. I mean, there are people that want to get on with the show here. And
well,
the
Prime Minister of Singapore is dealing with a country that has a large Muslim population, and they're all feeling, I mean, there's this broad consensus in the Muslim world that there's a crusade going on. That when George Bush used that word, it was no accident.
Yeah, well, there may be a crusade going on, you know, obviously. I mean, I don't know, it's very disheartening because again, there is so much that we can do. You talked last week about the world population. These problems are solvable with creative, positive mindset. I think the worst threat to security are the politics of fear and mistrust. You know, it's amazing how lucky you are when you're operating at a high level, how well things go, how you just ward off trouble, you know, when it comes your way. And we're on a downward slide here.
There
I hope
go.
We can get out of it, man.
Yeah, well said, Dave. Thanks a lot for sharing that with us. I am very concerned, too. The damage that the Bush administration has done to this country is going to last at least a generation. And I mourn that. The fact that my children are going to have, today, right now, my children face less opportunity than I did when I was their age. And the world is a less safe place and a more toxic place than it was when I was a kid. And that's not the direction things should be going. Things should be going in the other direction. And I lay that at the foot of the Bush administration. Javier, or is it Xavier in
Xavier.
Santa Cruz? Xavier.
Yeah. Well, you know, you changed subject on me, but I think I can keep up with you here.
Or you can come back to the other subject if you want.
Well, I'm optimistic about us actually pulling out of this quicker than a generation. I actually feel that as horrible as what happened needed to happen, there are just too many people who are just needed to have it their way and see that their way doesn't work.
But the thing is, the Bush is appointing, I mean, he's appointed now almost half of all the judges in the federal bench right now have been appointed by George W. Bush, because the Republicans for the last 5 years of the Clinton presidency and very, very powerfully during the last 3 years, but by and large, the last 5 years of the Clinton presidency, they would not allow there to be federal judges installed. And so there were just all these vacancies when George Bush came into office, because the Republicans have been holding those benches, those seats open Because they thought, you know, a Republican president is coming. We're not going to let Clinton appoint these people. So here you have half of all the federal judges in America appointed by George W. Bush. And he's going to appoint at least two, probably three or four members of the Supreme Court. That impact is going to last for 40, 50, maybe 100 years.
Never underestimate the power of the people, though. And I think that with the mess that George Bush has created, the fact that he probably hasn't been elected either of the two times he's gotten in, all the stuff that he's pulled, what's to stop us from basically recalling these judges?
Yeah, well, that's easier said than done. But your point is well taken, Xavier. In fact, you're making the point that I usually make. You're making the point that I usually make when people call me and they're all in despair and they're, oh, my God, you know, it's going down the tubes. And my point is, you know, don't ever underestimate the power of the people. And an awakened populace is a very, very, very powerful thing. And that's happening in America. And it's happening more and more. But it still has a ways to go.
Yeah.
It still has a ways to go. We all have work to do. Yeah.
Can I put in a quick plug for Joseph Campbell?
Sure.
Power of Myth is a series on PBS and available in many libraries. And one of the things he points out about this last subject you're talking about was that myth is not a lie. It's just like a map that people hang things on. We as humans can't know everything, so we create parables and like examples of stuff to fill in where we don't have understanding. And that's why I think that creationism is fine. You know, it just doesn't, it's not science, you know. It's just a map. So that's my point.
Okay. Good point, Xavier.
Okay.
Good point. And that's my point, too, was saying, you know, I have no problem with creationism being taught in our public schools as long as it's taught in a comparative religion class because it's not science. And that's where these guys, you know, they're trying to sneak this stuff in and they're trying to do it with our tax dollars. And that is not what Jesus would have done. It's just, you know, it's very, very clear to me. It's not what Jesus would have done. And so how can they, well, you've heard the rant. Karl Rove, in 2000, time for a little flashback here. This is from the Think Progress blog. During the 2000 presidential campaign, Karl Rove, then Bush campaign strategist, he goes on to Fox News. Now, this was part of the campaign to tear down Al Gore, right? Al Gore and George W. Bush are running against each other for president. And the way that they're going to tear down Al Gore, keep in mind, the whole strategy of the Republicans, since they don't have anything forward to put forward, there's no vision for the Republicans. They just want to tear down the New Deal. They want to tear down Social Security. They want to tear down environmental protections. They want to tear down worker protections. They want to tear down the unions. They want to tear down safety standards. They want to tear down unemployment insurance. They want to tear down the benefits for the military. The only thing that they're in favor of is protecting CEOs who are making millions of dollars and throwing much, much more money into the hands of defense contractors in the oil industry. Because that's who they represent. You know, if you're a multinational corporation, the Republicans are there for you. If you're an average Joe, the Republicans could give a hoot. But they will toss you gay marriage and flag burning and, you know, whatever other, quote, cultural issue that they can during an election year. They're always about that. In George Herbert Walker Bush's campaign, the first Bush, it was the flag amendment. Let's in every state in the country, we're going to have an amendment to ban burning of the flag. And for George W. Bush, it was gay marriage. We got to stop those gays from getting married. It's going to be an epidemic. And a little problem. So anyhow, Karl Rove's in 2000. They're going after Al Gore. And boy, are they going after Al Gore. And Karl Rove goes on Fox News, and he says, and I quote, "The vice president has some trouble telling the truth. And now he says he made mistakes. Those weren't mistakes. These involved violations of the law. People are going to jail over this. This is more than just a little teensy-weensy mistake. These are very substantive questions about the ethical conduct about the vice president and his ability to tell the truth." End of quote. From Karl Rove. Sound kind of familiar? Now, they were talking, what he was talking about was the Buddhist temple campaign fundraiser. Karl Rove goes on Fox News, March 12th. "And we now know there are photographs that exist of the meeting. Let's release all the photographs. The vice president has the authority to do this. Let's release all the photographs of the meeting and see how attentive the vice president was. Now, in addition to this, MediaMatters.org has pointed out that even the New York Times has taken to, this is either sloppy journalism or it's sucking up to power, getting in bed with the cons. But even the New York Times has taken to quoting Karl Rove's spin coming out of the White House. This having to do with the suggestion that President Bush could decline to fire Karl Rove over outing the CIA agent because Bush merely said that his pledge was to take appropriate action against leakers. Now, this spin, this was in an article written by David Sanger in the New York Times. As Media Matters notes, in advancing this spin, Sanger selectively quoted from a press conference in which Bush responded to a question about whether he stood by his pledge to fire anyone found to have leaked the agent's name. Sanger then quoted unnamed White House officials, gee, I wonder if it was Karl Rove himself, saying that if Rove merely identified Plame, which Rove reportedly did when he told Time magazine reporter Matt Cooper about her, rather than named her, and Bush took no action, Bush would not be violating Bush's pledge to fire the leaker. But in repeating this, Sanger ignored a little bit of reality. For example, from the July 13 New York Times, Mr. Bush was asked, from September 29, 2003, White House press briefing. Question, Scott, has the president tried to find out who outed the CIA agent and has he fired anyone in the White House yet? McClellan, well, Helen, that's assuming a lot of things. First of all, this is not the way this White House operates. The president expects everyone in his administration to adhere to the highest standards of conduct. No one would be authorized to do such a thing. McClellan, the president has set high standards, the highest of standards, for people in his administration. He's made it very clear to people in his administration that he expects them to adhere to the highest standards. If anyone in this administration was involved in it, they would no longer be in this administration. So, you know, the New York Times helping Carl with his spin, even though here's Scotty McClellan back 2 years ago saying, we find out who it is, they're going to be fired. New York Times says, Bush doesn't really have to fire him. 10 minutes before the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Open the gates and seize the day. Don't be afraid and don't delay. Nothing can break us. No one can make us give our rights away.
There you go. Nothing can make us give our rights away. Well, George W. is doing his best. He's trying to scare us into it. Give your rights away. Yes, sir. You've got to reauthorize that Patriot Act. And it looks like Congress is going to do a good chunk of it, tragically, for democracy in America. One of many assaults on this great nation that the cons in this country have launched from day one, virtually. Of the Bush administration, it goes back to Reagan. This all goes back to the beginning of an administration that doesn't believe in governance. They believe these ideologues on the Reich. They believe that if government does it, it can be done better by a corporation. Pure and simple. Andy Borowitz weighing in on this today. This is great. Signaling a shift in strategy, the White House acknowledged today that the United States may not possess adequate forces to wage war against Iraq and against gay marriage at the same time. In the past, Pentagon planners had always formulated their budget requests on the assumption that the U.S. must be able to fight the insurgency in Iraq and the rising tide of gay marriages at home simultaneously. But that calculus has changed, the White House said. In a press briefing, spokesman Scotty McClellan acknowledged the difficulties of trying to wipe out the insurgency and gay weddings at the same time. It turns out that these insurgents are more determined than we originally expected, and so are these damn gay couples, says Scotty McClellan. Mr. McClellan also raised the possibility that the insurgency in Iraq could prevent the U.S. from continuing to fight the war on obesity. Let's face it, folks, Mr. McClellan said. For the near term, at least, we may be looking at a fatter, gayer America. Mr. McClellan's statements drew a sharp rebuke from Dr. Charles Helsinger, a persistent critic of the Pentagon who believes that the proposed shift in strategy is short-sighted. Dr. Helsinger says, while we're in Iraq, why don't we try and take out a few gay weddings and fat people over there? Time has come for these Pentagon pinheads to think outside the box. Yeah. Elsewhere, he says, after a visitor to Disney, MGM Studios suffered cardiac arrest while riding the Twilight Zone Tower of Terror, park officials said they would rename the ride Vioxx Mountain. Yeah. Thanks, Andy Borowitz, BorowitzReport.com. Thanks for being with us today, friends. Thanks to Kareth for engineering our program, to Louise for producing it. Thanks to you, thanks to the callers, thanks to the folks in our chat room for showing up in our chat room. Great conversation. Are we worshiping memories? Some of the strangest things go flying by. Well, that's for a discussion tomorrow. Thanks for being with us. We'll see you tomorrow. Same time, same place. Do good.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.